following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
A few years ago, I encountered a person in Baltimore, my hometown, by the name of Rabbi Porter, Rabbi Shlomo Porter. And he was telling me about a most remarkable product that he found in a high-tech store in Baltimore. It was a high-tech food product. It came very colorfully wrapped in bright red, green, or yellow wrappers. It was claimed to be all natural, and it even tastes good. It's good for you, nutritious, and the wrapper itself was designed so that when the food product had outlived its shelf life, the color changed so that you'd know not to buy it. Now, to give you the background of this remarkable product, we need to go back in time. So, what I'd like you to all imagine is that we're in a time machine. And we're going to start moving back in time. You can look out the window over here, and all of a sudden we're moving. We look out the window, you see a beautiful, beautiful, deep blue sky over the Pacific Ocean. And a lone American B-29 bomber heading toward a obscure Japanese town by the name of Hiroshima. But we're going to go even further back in time. We're going back further and further. And all of a sudden we look out, we see a ragtag band of Indians being chased by the American cavalry to a place called the Little Bighorn, the commander of the Americans being General George Armstrong Custer. But we're going to go even further back. We see Rome, a great city, in flames, and this little funny man in a tower playing a fiddle while Rome burns. We're going to go even further back. Further back. Almost 3,000 years to the dedication of the first temple right over here in Yerushalayim. And huge numbers of people prostrated outside of the temple. And this incredibly brilliant light blasting out of the windows coming from inside out of the temple. But we're going to go back even further in time. I see a big swamp out of the window. And a huge 80-foot brontosaurus munching on gigantic leaves while a 20-foot pteranodon glides overhead. But we're going to go even further back to a world covered with volcanoes, though it's spewing steam into the atmosphere. That steam which will eventually condense and form the oceans that we know today. But even further back, a big ball of gas coming together and beginning to glow in thermonuclear fusion to form our sun. But even further back, the universe is getting smaller and smaller and smaller until eventually we come to this glowing universe all the way back to a point of the Big Bang itself. And now, we're going to come forward again in time. But we're going to look at some different things on the way forward than we did on the way back. The first thing, we see the Big Bang. It turns out that if I were to make the Big Bang just a little bit weaker than it was, tiny little bit weaker, you wouldn't have a Big Bang. You'd have a little puff. The universe would go like this and collapse right again because the explosion wasn't powerful enough to overcome all the gravity. Supposing you had made the Big Bang a little bit stronger. Tiny little bit stronger. You wouldn't have a Big Bang. You'd have a big puff. Because the universe would fly apart so fast that you'd never have an opportunity for stars, planets to form. It would just be subatomic particles spread out in space. The question is, how much can I change the power of the Big Bang so that we still have a universe to talk about? And it can be calculated. It is 1/1,000,000,000 of a billionth, 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 of a tenth of a percent. And I counted them. For those of you who are interested in scientific notation, 10 to the minus 120. A decimal point and 120 zeros and a one of a percent. Change it more than that in one direction or the other, no universe worth talking about. Michael Turner, astrophysicist at University of Chicago and Fermilab, and I quote, "The precision is as if one could throw a dart across the entire universe and hit a bullseye 1 millimeter in diameter on the other side." And I would add, blindfolded. Stephen Hawking, one of the greatest scientists of our day, and I quote, this is from his book, A Brief History of Time, is a best-selling book, Brief History of Time from the Big Bang to Black Holes. And I quote, "The initial rate of expansion also would have had to have been chosen very precisely for the rate of expansion still to be so close to the critical rate needed to avoid recollapse. It would be very difficult to explain why the universe should have begun this way, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us." Now, it's worth noting that Hawking himself is not necessarily a believer in God. That's why he says it is very difficult to explain. He doesn't say there's no other explanation, but he's finding a lot of difficulty. In fact, he's having so much difficulty, he didn't choose his words very well, because if you go back to the first sentence, to have been chosen, if something is chosen, that means there's a chooser. Maybe he didn't realize that that slipped out, it was a Freudian slip. So, the initial force of the Big Bang was so finely tuned so that there would be a universe worth talking about. If it was moved the most infinitesimal amount, one way or the other, no universe. Either it collapses back again, or it just spreads out into sort of nothingness. No explanation for it at all. That's what he says. It's very difficult to, you know, why did it happen? Now, if that was just the only thing, maybe we could dismiss it as an anomaly. But let's consider something else. We're going to move forward. Maybe a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. And talk about the laws of nature. This is a famous problem called the horizon problem. Now, the laws of nature are the same wherever we look. In other words, gravity and some, you know, wood burns and water doesn't burn, things like that. All the laws of nature are the same everywhere. That is, if we take a telescope and we look as far as we can to that end of the universe, or as far as we can to that end of the universe, everything we see is consistent with all the laws of nature that we know. Nothing unusual. Nothing that can't be explained in terms of the laws of nature. So we take it for granted. Well, you know, why not? But there's a very good reason why not. Because according to physics, the laws of nature did not come into existence at the moment of the Big Bang. The laws of nature came into existence a small fraction of a second after the Big Bang. Now, this is very important. The laws of nature, presumably, should be random. According to physics, just random. It just happened to be whatever it happened to be. Could have been anything. Now, it turns out that if it could have been anything, why couldn't one end of the universe decide on some laws of nature and another part of the universe decide on some other laws of nature? Well, there's one possible explanation why that couldn't be. And that is that as soon as one end of the universe came in contact with another end of the universe, somehow that contact would sort of cause a some average type of laws of nature to come out in both places. Like, you know, if you have a heater in one end of the room and a air conditioner in the other, for a little while, one end of the room might be much hotter than the other end of the room. But if you just stop the heater and the air conditioner and leave it be, eventually it'll equalize to something in between. And so it should be the same over here, except for one thing. And that's why it's known as the horizon problem. And that is that if you look as far as you can in that direction, as far as you can in that direction, those two ends of the universe are beyond the horizon of each other. That is to say, they have never been in any kind of contact at all. Because from the time that the laws of nature came into existence, they were racing away from each other so fast that even light, the fastest thing in the universe, would not have been able to reach from one part to the other part. It was going away too fast. So there was no communication between these two ends of the universe, and yet somehow they both decided on the same laws of nature. Now that's a problem without a solution. American Scientist, September 1983, article on the origin of the universe, and I quote, "It looks as if someone has arranged it so that it is the same all over, even in places that could have had no possible communication with each other." Now again, American Scientist, which is one of the premier journals in the United States, scientific journals, is not going to say that God arranged it or someone arranged it. But nevertheless, the truth is it looks like someone has arranged it, and that's what they say. Encyclopedia of Physical Science and Technology, Volume 3, page 743, and I quote, "What is meant by the laws of physics predating the universe?" In other words, it almost looks like somehow someone came up with all these laws of physics, and then the universe was expanding, and at a certain point, they imposed this external laws on the entire universe at once. And then they were asking the question, but what does that mean? Because there was nothing else. So how could, you know, what does it mean that it looks like that? Again, no answer to that question. Let's take a look at another phenomenon, the number of dimensions, something we take for granted all the time, right? Everyone knows there are how many dimensions? Three dimensions?
Four that we know about.
Four that we know about. Okay, so three spatial dimensions, and then there's a dimension of time. The fact of the matter is that it's beginning to look very much like, in fact, there are not four dimensions, but there are, in fact, 10 dimensions. Now, where are these dimensions? I mean, you know, we read about these in the comic books, right? But let's talk in realistic. Where are these dimensions? Where do they come from? Why don't we see them? By the way, this is part of what's known as string theory, or sometimes now called M theory. Let's try to introduce the concept with... How many dimensions is this card? You see, now some say two and some say three. The fact is that you're both correct. It really is three dimensions. But one dimension is so small that for all practical purposes I can't use it. So I'm really only using two dimensions, right? So as far as I'm concerned, it's a two-dimensional object, even though it really does have a third dimension, which is extremely tiny. And that is exactly the case with our universe. There's one time dimension. There are three large spatial dimensions that we all know about. And then there are six more dimensions that are so incredibly tiny. And we're talking about a millionth of 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 an inch. That's how big they are. So small you cannot see them. So small you cannot detect them. But you can perform experiments that verify that there must be that many dimensions, because without those dimensions, this experiment couldn't do what it does. For example, take the Earth. The Earth looks flat, right? As far as you can see, the Earth looks flat. Do an experiment. Send a ship around the ocean. It comes back from the other side. The only explanation, it's not flat. It curves around and comes back again, right? Even though you don't see it. Well, now we can go up an airplane and we can see the curvature of the Earth, but I'm saying that's a simple experiment that proves the Earth is curved, even in those days when you really couldn't see the curvature. Same thing over here. There are very subtle experiments that will show that there are other dimensions, even though you can't see them and measure them. But they have to be there. Now, okay, that's interesting, but so what? So there are six hidden dimensions, so to speak, you know, tiny little dimensions. But there's a problem. Again, Hawking. Why should some, but not all, of the dimensions be curled up into a small ball? There would be problems with more than three space dimensions. The gravitational force would decrease more rapidly with distance than in three dimensions, and stars would not be able to exist in a stable state. In other words, if one of these six small dimensions were a big dimension, like the three spatial dimensions we have, there'd be no stars. No stars, no planets. No stars, no planets, no us. Interesting. Atoms, too, would be unstable. It seems clear that life as we know it could exist only in space-time, in which one time dimension and three space dimensions are not curled up small. So here we have another fortuitous happening, another coincidence, if you will. First, the Big Bang is tuned so precisely so there should be a universe worth talking about. Then we find that the laws of nature are the same everywhere, even though they shouldn't be, according to pure science. They're somehow imposed from something outside. And then we find out that there really are six other dimensions, and it's a good thing that these dimensions are so small that we've never seen them, because if they were big enough for us to see, we wouldn't be here to see them. Three dimensions, no more, no less. Let's talk about the formation of stars. We're coming up now in time to the place where gas starts condensing to form the stars. We, by the way, are all made of stardust. Everything that we are composed of was originally inside a star. Now let's see why, and let's see why that's important. You see, the original universe contained only hydrogen, helium, and a small amount of lithium. Nothing else. There was no carbon. There was no iron. There was no gold. There was nothing else. Hydrogen, helium, lithium, perhaps a tiny, tiny amount of beryllium, and that's it. So where did all these other elements come from? Well, you see, what happens is that when the star forms, when all these gases come together, and by gravitational attraction, they become very hot, they start a thermonuclear fusion, a fusion reaction, like a hydrogen bomb. And now these chemicals fuse, the hydrogen and the helium and the lithium, they fuse to form the heavier elements. And in this process, they can produce all of the elements up to and including iron, but nothing heavier than iron, up to iron. What would happen? Now, of course, these stars are formed by gravitational attraction. What would happen if the gravitational attraction was just a tiny little bit more than it actually is? If it was a tiny little bit more, you see, then stars would be about 1.4 times the size that they are today. They would burn very furiously and hot, so fast they would burn themselves out, there would be no way that they could support any kind of life. On the other hand, make gravitational attraction just a tiny little bit less, then stars would be about 0.8 the size of stars today. And what would happen is they wouldn't be hot enough to produce all the heavy elements that are needed to support life, in particular carbon, which is the most important. Because it turns out that life, all life, even alien life, if there is such a thing, must be based on carbon. It cannot be based on anything else, because carbon is the only atom known of all the atoms which can form long chains and very complicated molecules. The only other ones that come even close are silicon and boron, and neither one of them can produce any kind of complexity even approaching carbon. So, if gravity had not been tuned just precisely as it has been, there would be no life. So here we see a Big Bang which is tuned very carefully to produce a universe. Laws of nature are set so that they're uniform throughout the universe. No explanation. This is known as the horizon problem. It's an open question in physics. Why should it be so? No answer given. Number three, the number of dimensions is such that we ought not to be around. There should be no atoms. There should be no suns. But six of the dimensions, just the right amount, are very, very tiny so that we can exist, so that stars can exist. And finally, the force of gravity is tuned so perfectly so that the stars will not be too hot and not be too cold, produce enough carbon so that there will be life, and so on. The force of gravity, by the way, also leads us to another unsolved problem of physics called the uniformity problem. Consider the initial Big Bang. The universe is expanding mass. Now, it would seem that it ought to be uniform. In other words, that it should be exactly the same in anywhere in this tiny little universe. There's no reason why any one place should be different than any other place. It turns out that if, in fact, it were that way, there would be no universe. Why? Very simple. Because if it's completely uniform, the force of gravity is exactly the same everywhere. And therefore, you'll never have enough gravity in any one place to begin collecting atoms into one place to form a star. So what you would have is a completely uniform haze of electrons and protons and neutrons and so on, but you would basically have, you may even have atoms, but you wouldn't have any kind of stars or anything like that, because the force of gravity would be exactly the same in all directions. You wouldn't have a surfeit of gravity in one place that begins to attract everything and make a star in one place or a galaxy. So therefore, if it was completely uniform, you'd have a completely uniform universe, and a completely uniform universe has nothing in it except for the uniformity. There's no stars, there's no planets, certainly no us. This room is not uniform, right? You have more mass over here, less mass over here. more mess. Oh, no, I shouldn't talk about that. Anyway. Now, supposing you say, okay, so it couldn't be completely uniform, so it's got to have some wrinkles in it. Very good. How big can the wrinkles be? It turns out they can't be very big. You know why? Because if the wrinkle is too big, there's too much mass in some places, what happens is the gravity is so powerful, it attracts everything there and it collapses into what's known as a black hole. So you end up with a universe of black holes. A universe of black holes, again, there are no suns, no carbon being produced, no nothing. So the wrinkles have to be very carefully adjusted. As a matter of fact, it turns out that the wrinkles have to be adjusted so finely, they're so small, that if you were to put it on the size, for example, of an orange, it would look perfectly smooth to you. You'd have to have an extremely powerful microscope before you'd even begin to discern that there were wrinkles. That's how small those wrinkles got to be. And if they were a drop bigger, forget it. And if they were a drop smaller, forget it. Perfectly tuned wrinkles in the universe. That's called the uniformity problem. It's an open problem in physics. Why is the universe exactly the amount of uniformity needed to make an interesting universe? No scientific answer to that question. We have a very similar thing with the electromagnetic force. The electromagnetic force is what causes chemical bonds. So now we're advancing into the universe in a place. By the way, I stopped by your house before and knocked on the door, but you weren't home.
How long have you?
Just till Tuesday morning. But please. Good. Again, the electromagnetic force is responsible for bonds, chemical bonds between atoms, and also for holding the protons the electrons in orbit around the nucleus of the atom. Again, what happens if you make the electromagnetic force just a tiny little bit weaker than it is? Well, then the electrons are no longer held in orbit, so you don't have any atoms. You have no atoms, you have no us. Make the electromagnetic force just a tiny little bit stronger. Great, you now have atoms. But the electrons are held so tightly, they'll never share them with other atoms, which means that you form no compounds. All you have is the elements, carbon, zinc, iron. You can't make anything out of those. You have to have carbon molecules like amino acids and so on to get life. So either way, no life. Again, the electromagnetic force has got to be tuned precisely to allow life. Now, we said before that the key to life is carbon. Without carbon, forget it. There's no life. I mean, we can predict right now, I have no idea if there's any kind of aliens out there. And if there are, I have no idea what they look like, although I've seen many science fiction movies. But one thing I can tell you, they've got to contain carbon. Because if they don't, then they're going to be very simple compounds. That there's no complexity in there. There's no genes. There's no information in there that can possibly produce any kind of life. Even if it's just germs, bacteria, got to be based on carbon. Where does carbon come from? Well, carbon is manufactured in the stars. But it's interesting. New Scientist, 19 August 1989, and I quote, "Carbon is manufactured inside stars thanks to a remarkable coincidence that was first pointed out by Fred Hoyle in the 1950s. An alpha particle, that's a nucleus of a helium atom, and a nucleus of beryllium-8 can stick together to form carbon-12. Only because the nucleus has an energy level at precisely the right place. The amount of time for the interaction is 1/1,000,000,000 of a second. And in that time, it's like 1/1,000,000,000 of a second to get a key into a hole. And that key in that hole better be aligned perfectly, because if they're not, you're not going to get it in. The energy levels are exactly matched so that these two things can stick together and form carbon. What they call a remarkable coincidence, added up to all the other remarkable coincidences that we have been finding in our travel forward in time from the Big Bang. Now, we said before that all the elements essential to life, to everything, comes from the stars. The question is two questions, actually. Number one is, how do they get out of the stars? Because if they're in the star, we don't exist in stars. How did the stuff get out of the star to form us? And another question is, remember I said that we only produce the elements up to iron. The question is, how do you get the elements from iron upward toward uranium, which includes, by the way, chemicals like iodine, which is essential to life. iodine has a higher atomic number than iron. Well, it turns out that this is what's called a supernova. When the star burns up all of its fuel, all of a sudden it's like burnt out ember in space. The tremendous heat of the thermonuclear fusion is no longer there to keep the pressure and keep the star so-called alive. And so the star begins to collapse. And it collapses, by the way, very fast, like hundreds of miles a second. That's how fast it's collapsing under this tremendous gravity. But you know what's in the center? In the center of the star is a core of solid iron. That's the end result of the fusion. It can only go up to iron. And so when this envelope of the star is rushing it at hundreds of miles a second, crashes into this iron, it causes a tremendous explosion, which can give off more light than an entire galaxy. It's called a supernova. And it spews all this stuff out into space. And that's how, number one, the trans iron elements are formed. They're formed by this tremendous explosion. And that's also how they get out of the star to form us. So we are actually, the carbon in the suit and me was originally in a star. It was manufactured in a star. It wasn't in the original universe. It had to get out. Now, but here's an interesting point, you see. Supposing I make gravity just a little bit weaker than it actually is. If I make it weaker, then it's not going to form the heavier elements. In other words, the crash is going to be a much milder crash. It's not going to have enough energy to form the heavy elements past iron that are also needed for life. If I make gravity a little bit stronger, then what happens is that everything collapses, and then it can't get out again because gravity is holding it. So there's no explosion, so the elements never get out. So once again, gravity has to be finely tuned to ensure, number one, that the heavy elements are formed, and number two, that they get out of the star where they can do some good. But there's a problem here. We've talked about gravity before, remember? We fine-tuned gravity just a few minutes ago in forming the stars to begin with. And now we're fine-tuning it again. What happens when you try to fine-tune the same thing twice? How do you know it's going to be in the same place? Let me give you an example. Most of you are probably too young. I know that you have kids. I'm old enough that I have some kids. Some of you maybe are also. Well, back in America, one of the things you like to do, you know, you have a backyard. So you have these toys you put in the backyard, swing sets, slides, you know, for the kids to play on. Now, the great things, they come with the instructions. They tell you what to do. And you have these big metal things, and each one has a hole. And what you do is you put a bolt through the hole and a nut on the other side, and it connects these two pieces, right? I see some people smiling. You've had the experience, maybe doing it for a kid brother or a kid sister or something. Now, everything goes along fine. There's no problem until you've got two parts that have already been put together, and now the last step is not to get two pieces and put a bolt through, but to get four pieces and put a bolt through. Remember that? The last step? Get the piece from here, the piece from here, the piece from here. Now, the problem is that the piece from here is connected to the piece from there. It's over there. This piece is connected over here. So you can get these two pieces together, get these two. But once this is set over here, it's not over there. So then you've got to somehow pull all the parts and try to get all the four things aligned and get that bolt through there, right? And that takes as much time as putting the whole thing together up to that point. That's what we have over here. We've already fine-tuned gravity so stars can form. Let's say we fine-tuned it, we say it has to be here. But now we find another reason to fine-tune gravity. Fine, so you're going to fine-tune it again, but why does it have to be in exactly the same place? But it does, it's not going to work. So not only is it fine-tuned, it's fine-tuned twice in exactly the same place for two separate things. So obviously someone is putting together something very, very carefully. No room for error. Okay, let's come forward in time. Planets. For the longest time, we knew there were planets around the sun, right? We're not only the Earth, there's Mercury and Venus and going further out after the Earth, there's Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and eventually they found Pluto. The biggest question was always, I wonder if there are any planets around any other stars. And it's only over the last couple of years that they began to find that they can detect planets and others around other stars. To date, meaning as of a few days ago, they had located 28 planets going around stars other than our sun, distant solar systems. Distant stars in the galaxy. And they found a surprise. Of the 28, 24 of them were not extremely close to their star. Okay, so we're dealing with 24. There were four of them that were very close, within less than one-fifth of the distance between the sun and the earth. So we're going to discount them. We're talking about the other 24. It turns out that every single one of them has a highly elliptical orbit. In other words, the orbit does not look like this. It looks like that. Okay? Now, for the ones that are very close to the star, they can't look like that, because if they look like that, they go through the sun. They'd be pulled into the sun. So it's no surprise that the ones that are very close to the star are going to be in circular orbits. But as soon as you get about one-fifth of the distance from the Earth to the sun and any other star, every single planet, 24 of them, every single one has a highly elliptical orbit. It turns out that in our solar system, the Earth and a few of the planets all have circular orbits. This is the exception to the rule, because it looks like planets should have elliptical orbits. And in fact, the data shows you that unless it's so close to the sun that if it was elliptical, it would have been pulled into their sun, anything that's left over there has got to be elliptical. And yet over here, we have circular orbits. But the interesting thing is that if the Earth had an elliptical orbit, we wouldn't be here to talk about it. Because when it came close to the sun, we'd all roast. And then when it came far away from the sun, we'd all freeze. Life would never form. The only way for life to form and to exist on this planet is the fact that the temperature is within a reasonable variation, which means a circular or almost circular orbit and not a highly elliptical orbit. So again, a strange coincidence that although it looks like the norm is for planets to have elliptical orbits, here, where we need life, where we have life, we have circular orbits instead. Let's come even closer up in time and talk about something that we all know about. And that's water. Do things contract or expand when they get cold? In general. No, water contracts also, just like everything else. If you go into a lake or the ocean early in the season, right, there's nice strong sun, but it's cold, you know, still. And the top of the water could be warm, but when your feet hit the bottom, isn't it cold down there? The cold water is always at the bottom, right? As a matter of fact, in your hot water heater, right? They always feed the cold water in through the bottom and take out the hot water from the top, because the hot water will always be found on top of the cold water on the bottom. Okay? Just like everything else. And same thing with mercury, right? In the thermometer, that's why the mercury goes down when it's cold, because it's contracting. Metals contract. Everything contracts when it gets cold. There is an exception, and this is what you're thinking about. It's not water, it's ice. You see, because as soon as water begins to form ice, it begins to expand instead of contract. The one exception. Now the question is, what difference does it make? One exception. And the answer is that if ice were to contract instead of expand, like everything else does, I'm sorry, if it was to, yeah, then the Titanic would not have sunk. Now can anyone tell me why the Titanic would not have sunk? Because what? That's right, because the iceberg would not have floated, because if ice, instead of expanding, condensed, got smaller, then it would also be denser than water, and it would sink. So the iceberg would not have been on top, it would have been on the bottom of the ocean, and therefore the Titanic would not have hit an iceberg and sunk. That's one reason. Now let's get an even better reason why the Titanic would not have sunk. Right, there wouldn't have been any water. You wouldn't have had to have a Titanic. The reason is that as the water freezes, it would sink to the bottom. And since it's now at the bottom where the sun is not shining, it would stay frozen. And the next layer would now freeze. So what would happen is eventually the entire ocean would freeze up, except perhaps for the top 20 or 30 feet of water, which was warmed by the sun. The rest of it would all be frozen. And it would stay that way. So you would never have needed a Titanic to go across the ocean. Now let's get an even more primitive reason why the Titanic would not have sunk. Because, what? Precisely so. Because if the ocean had frozen like that, there would be virtually no oxygen in the atmosphere, because the oxygen is produced, contrary to what everyone thinks, by the Amazon rainforest. That's only a small amount. Most of the oxygen in the atmosphere is produced by plant life in the sea. And most of that plant life would have been killed. The whole ecosystem would have been destroyed. There wouldn't have been any life, and there wouldn't have been anyone to build a Titanic. Let's talk about proteins and amino acids. The simplest protein is made up of at least 100 amino acids. Some of them are made up of as many as 500 amino acids. An amino acid is a very complicated molecule based, of course, on carbon. It's put together in a very complex three-dimensional shape. And if it's not exactly the right shape, the amino acid doesn't work. The specification of a protein, of a single protein, requires 1,000 minimum, absolute minimum of 1,000 nucleotides. A nucleotide is an instruction as to where this amino acid is placed within the protein. So 1,000 instructions to tell you how to build this one protein out of these 500 or so amino acids, turn it this exactly this way, exactly here, this in the 3D shape, and if it's not the right thing, it doesn't work. And finally, once you have the protein, you require a minimum, an absolute minimum of 100 workable proteins put in exactly the right way to form the simplest cell that's alive. How does all of that come together? Just by chance. And by the way, it better do it all at once, because if you only have half of the cell, it doesn't work. The Nobel Prize-winning biochemist Francis Crick, in his book Life Itself, Simon & Schuster, 1981, and I quote, "An honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to be satisfied to get it going." Notice he says almost a miracle because Francis Crick is an atheist. So he can't admit that it's a miracle. We don't believe in miracles, but it's almost a miracle. It's as close to a miracle as he can get. We are now in a position to understand the high-tech product that Rabbi Porter showed me at the very beginning of this talk. That high-tech product which is nutritious and which is made up of natural ingredients, colorful wrappers, red, green, yellow, that change color when it's out of its shelf life. Why? It's just an apple. It's an apple. It was manufactured by God to be nutritious, to taste good, and to change color when it's spoiled so you know not to eat it. We don't do that yet, but God does that. Hawking, and I quote, "What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? Why does the universe go to all the bother of existing? Is the unified theory so compelling that it brings about its own existence? Or does it need a creator?" That's Hawking, the atheist. But he can't help thinking about it looks like it. I remember when I was my kids were small, I once took him to the Hayden Planetarium in New York City. And the narrator mentioned an interesting thing. He says, you know, there are 65 moons in our solar system. One of them, of course, is our moon, and the other 64 are around the other planets. There are 65 moons in our solar system. Our moon appears to be exactly the same size as the sun from the Earth. Not because it is the same size. Of course, it's much smaller, but it's also much closer. So between being much closer and being much smaller, it looks like it's exactly the same size. Therefore, when there is a total solar eclipse, the moon precisely blots out the sun, and you have a beautiful phenomenon called the corona around the sun, which is a beautiful thing to see. Of course, you have to watch it through the right glasses. So the next time there's an eclipse, make sure to find out how to watch it properly so you don't destroy your retina. But it's a beautiful sight to see. You can look at photographs of it. It's beautiful. If the sun would appear to be just a little bit bigger than the moon, then you'd have a ring of fire around the moon and you wouldn't see the corona. If it was a little bit smaller, the corona would be hidden behind the moon too. So it's got to be exactly the right size so we can see. Said the narrator, he says, you know, it's interesting. He says, if you look at all the other 64 moons, there's not a single one of them that looks to be the same size as the sun from its planet. He says, you know, it's almost as if someone knew that we would be here to appreciate this beautiful phenomenon. We can actually take it one step further. Look at a sunset. It's beautiful, right? Why? Why does a sunset have to be beautiful? Why does it have to give us this beautiful display of colors on the clouds and everything like that? Look at a flower. Why does it have to be beautiful? Why does it have to smell pretty? It could do its job without smelling pretty for us. Is it perhaps because God gave us a gift? He wanted to please us. He wanted to give us pleasure. He made the flowers smell nice for our pleasure. It doesn't have to smell nice to us. It could have smelled ugly. He did it to please us. He made that apple to look pretty and to taste good for our pleasure and to have the vitamins for our nutrition. That's a loving God. That's not just a God who turned on a universe and said goodbye. That's a God who was concerned at the moment of the Big Bang that you should enjoy that apple, that you should enjoy the smell of that flower, that you should fall in love with that tiny little baby. I have a suggestion for you. The next time you're going to eat an apple, just before you eat it, close your eyes for a second. Picture the Big Bang. Picture that primordial explosion way back in time. And a God who at that moment was planning that you should have this apple to eat out of that Big Bang. And that it should taste good for you and should be nutritious for you. A God that loves you. And after that thought, thank Him. Make a bracha. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam. Thank you, O God, Lord of the universe. Barei Pri Ha'etz, who made the fruit of the tree, and then eat it and enjoy it. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a complete listing of our cassettes, see our web store at aish.com. For a free cassette catalog, email us at voices@aish.com or call toll-free in the U.S., 1-800-VOICES-3. Our main office is at 1 Western Wall Plaza, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.